epoxide, among others. Klonopin, clonazepam, a longer-acting benzodiazepine that may have greater effect on serotonin, has had success in treating symptoms of aggression and anxiety, and so is perhaps the only benzodiazepine that may be useful for BPD. Opiate antagonists. Revia, naltrexone, blocks the body's release of its own endorphins, which induce analgesia and euphoric feelings. Some reports suggest that this medicine may inhibit self-mutilating behavior. Other treatments. Homeopathic or herbal treatments have generally been unsuccessful, with the exception of omega-3 fatty acid preparation. One small study found that the substance did decrease aggressiveness and depression among women. Two substances that modulate the neurotransmitter glutamate have been investigated in BPD. The amino acid N-acetylcysteine and Rilutek, riluzole, a drug used for the treatment of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, were reported to significantly diminish self-injurious behavior in two borderline patients. The APA's practice guideline recommends that medications target a specific symptom cluster. Guidelines divide BPD symptoms into three primary groups: mood instability, impulse discontrol, and cognitive perceptual distortions. A word about off-label use. The FDA, Food and Drug Administration, has not formally approved any drug for the treatment of BPD, so all of the medicines commonly used for treating BPD are considered off-label. Though the term off-label may be off-putting, if not seem downright risky to the uninitiated, off-label prescribing is quite common for a wide variety of conditions. Because a pharmaceutical company spends almost $1 billion on average to bring a drug to market, many companies do not seek approval for a wide range of conditions or outside narrow dosage ranges, as these strategies might narrow the chances for FDA approval and greatly increase the cost of development. For example, even though it is known that SRIs benefit several conditions, including depression, PTSD, anxiety illnesses, and some pain disorders, the drug manufacturer may not want to absorb the extra expense of gaining FDA approval, nor risk FDA rejection, by applying for label use for all of these indications and/or broad dosage ranges. Whenever a physician prescribes a medicine for an unapproved condition, or at a dose outside of recommendations, it is considered off-label. Unfortunately, managed care agencies may refuse approval of these sometimes expensive off-label prescriptions. Generic drugs. In simplest terms, a generic drug contains the same primary or active ingredient as the original formulation. Generally speaking, it is almost always less expensive. However, this does not mean that a generic medication is identical to its brand name counterpart. The FDA considers a generic drug equivalent to a branded medicine if blood levels in healthy volunteers are within 20% variation, a significant difference in some patients. A generic may also differ from the original in its inactive ingredients and its delivery system, for example, tablet or capsule. Moreover, one generic may vary widely from another, theoretically up to a 40% variation in blood level. The lesson here is that if a switch to a generic drug will result in significant savings, it may be worth trying. However, if symptoms recur, it is best to return to the brand medicine. Additionally, if you are taking a generic medicine that's working, do not change to a different generic. Also, be aware that some pharmacies and some doctors receive bonuses for switching patients to generic drugs. Split treatment. Many patients receive care from more than one provider. Often, therapy may be administered by a non-medical professional, psychologist, social worker, or counselor, while medications are administered by a physician, psychiatrist, or primary care doctor. Advantages of this protocol include less expense, thus accounting for its encouragement by managed care companies, involvement of more professionals, and separation of therapy and medication issues. But this separation can also be a disadvantage, since it allows the potential for patients to split providers into good doctors and bad doctors, and to become confused about the treatment. Close communication among professionals treating the same patient is essential for the process to be successful. In most cases, a psychiatrist skilled in both medical management and psychotherapy techniques may be the preferred approach. Can borderlines be cured? Much like the disorder itself, professionals' opinion about the prognosis for those afflicted with BPD has whipsawed from one extreme to the other. In the 1980s, Axis II personality disorders were generally thought to be enduring and stable over time. DSM-3 asserted that personality disorders begin in childhood or adolescence and persist in stable form without periods of remission or exacerbation into adult life. This perception was in contrast to most Axis I disorders, such as major depression, alcoholism, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, etc., which were thought to be more episodic and responsive to pharmacological treatment. Suicide rates in BPD approached 10%. All of these considerations suggested that prognosis for BPD was likely to be poor. However, longer-term studies published over the last several years demonstrated significant improvement over time. In these studies, tracking borderlines over a 10-year period, up to two-thirds of the patients no longer exhibited 5 of the 9 defining criteria for BPD and therefore could be considered cured, since they no longer fulfilled the formal DSM definition. Improvement occurred with or without treatment, although treated patients achieved remission sooner. Most patients remained in treatment and relapses diminished over time. Despite these optimistic findings, it was also discovered that although these patients no longer could be formally designated as borderline, some continued to have difficulty with interpersonal functioning that impaired their social and vocational relationships. This suggests that the more acute and prominent symptoms of BPD, which primarily defined the disorder, such as suicidal or self-mutilating behaviors, destructive impulsivity, and quasi-psychotic thinking, are more quickly responsive to treatment or time than the more enduring temperamental symptoms, fears of abandonment, feelings of emptiness, dependency, etc. In short, although the prognosis is clearly much better than originally thought, some borderlines continue to struggle with ongoing issues. Those who conquer the illness display a greater capacity to trust and establish satisfactory, even if sometimes not very close, relationships. They have a clearer sense of purpose and a more stable understanding of themselves. In a sense, then, even if borderline issues remain, they become better borderlines. Chapter 10: Understanding and Healing. Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. From Through the Looking Glass by Lewis Carroll. I feel like I have a void in me that I can never quite fill. Elizabeth, an attractive, witty 28-year-old woman, was originally referred for therapy by her family doctor. She had been married for 6 years to a man who was 10 years older than her and had been her boss at one time. 5 months before, she had given birth to her first child, a daughter, and was now severely depressed. She yearned for something she could call her own, something that would show that the rest of the world knew I was here. Inside, she felt like her real self was a swamp of childish emotions, and that she was always hiding her feelings, which were ugly and bad. These realizations turned into self-hate. She wanted to give up. By her count, Elizabeth had engaged in 9 extramarital affairs over the previous 6 years, all with men she met through work. They began soon after the death of her father. Most were relationships that she totally controlled, first by initiating them and later by ending them. She had found it exciting that these men seemed so puzzled by her advances and then by her sudden rejections. She enjoyed the physical closeness, but acknowledged she dreaded being too emotionally involved. Although she controlled these relationships, she never found them sexually satisfying, nor was she sexually responsive to her husband. She admitted that she used sex to equalize relationships, to stay in control. She felt safer that way. Her intellect and personality, she felt, were not enough to hold a man. Reared in a working-class Catholic family, Elizabeth had three older brothers and a younger sister, who had drowned in a swimming accident at age 5. Elizabeth was only 8 at the time and had little understanding of the event except to observe her mother becoming more withdrawn. For as long as Elizabeth could remember, her mother had been hypercritical, constantly accusing Elizabeth of being bad. When she was a young girl, her mother insisted that she attend church with her and forced her father to construct an altar in Elizabeth's bedroom. Elizabeth felt closer to her father, a passive and quiet man who was dominated by his wife. As she entered puberty, he became more distant and less affectionate. Growing up, Elizabeth was quiet and shy. Her mother disapproved of her involvement with boys and closely watched her friendships with girls. She was expected to have acceptable friends. Her brothers were always her mom's favorites. Elizabeth would kid with them, trying to be one of the guys. Elizabeth achieved good grades in high school, but was discouraged from going to college. After graduation, she began working full-time as a secretary. As time went on, the conflicts with her mother escalated. Even in high school, Elizabeth's mother had denounced her as a tramp and constantly accused her of promiscuity, even though she had had no sexual experience. After a while, having endured the shouting contests with her mother, she saved enough money to move out on her own. During this turmoil, Elizabeth's boss, Lloyd, separated from his wife and became embroiled in a painful divorce. Elizabeth offered solace and sympathy. He reciprocated with encouragement and support. They began dating and married soon after his divorce was finalized. Naturally, her mother berated her for marrying a divorced man, particularly one who was 10 years older and a lapsed Catholic. Her father remained detached. 1 year after Elizabeth married, he died. 5 years later, her marriage was disintegrating, and Elizabeth was blaming her husband. She saw Lloyd as a thief who had stolen her youth. She was only 19 when she met him and needed to be taken care of so badly that she traded in her youth for security, the years when she could have been experimenting with what I wanted to be, could be, should have been. In the early stages of treatment, Elizabeth began to talk of David, her most recent and most important affair. He was 12 years older, a longtime family friend, and the parish priest. He was someone known and loved by her whole family, especially by her mother. He was the only man to whom Elizabeth felt connected. This was the only relationship that she did not control. On and off, over a period of 2 years, he would abruptly terminate the affair and then resurrect it. Later, she confessed to her psychiatrist that David was the father of her child. Her husband was apparently unaware. Elizabeth became more withdrawn. Her relationship with her husband, who was frequently away traveling, deteriorated. She became more alienated from her mother and brothers and allowed her few friendships to flounder. She resisted attempts to include her husband in therapy, feeling that Lloyd and her doctor colluded and favored his side. So even therapy reinforced her belief that she couldn't trust or place faith in anyone because she would only be disappointed. All her thoughts and feelings seemed to be laden with contradictions, as if she were in a labyrinth of dead-end paths. Her sexuality seemed the only way out of the maze. Her therapist was often the target of her complaints because he was the one in control. She would yell at him, accuse him of being incompetent, and threatened to stop therapy. She hoped he would get mad, yell back, and stop seeing her, or become defensive and plead with her to stay. But he did neither, and she railed against his unflappability as evidence that he had no feelings. Even though she was accustomed to her husband's frequent business trips, she started to become more frightened when left alone. During these trips, for reasons not yet clear to her, she slept on the floor. When Lloyd returned, she raged constantly at him. She became more depressed. suicide became less an option than a destiny, as if everything were leading to that end. Elizabeth's perception of reality became more frail. She yearned to be psychotic, to live in a fantasy world where she could go anywhere in her mind. The world would be so far removed from reality, no one, not even the best psychiatrist, could get to her and see what's underneath. In her daydreams, she envisioned herself protected by a powerful, handsome man who actively appreciated all of her admirable qualities and was endlessly attentive. She fantasized him as a previous teacher, then her gynecologist, then the family veterinarian, and eventually her psychiatrist. Elizabeth perceived all these men as powerful, but she also knew in the back of her mind that they were unavailable. Yet in her fantasies, they were overwhelmed by her charm and drawn irresistibly to her. When reality did not follow her script, when one of these men did not aggressively return her flirtations, she became despondent and self-loathing, feeling she was not attractive enough. Everywhere she looked, she saw women who were prettier, smarter, better. She wished her hair was prettier, her eyes a different color, her skin clearer. When she looked in a mirror, she did not see the reflection of a beautiful young woman, but an old hag with sagging breasts, a wide waist, plump calves. She despised herself for being a woman whose only value was her beauty. She longed to be a man like her brothers, so my mind would count. In her second year of outpatient therapy, Elizabeth experienced several losses, including the death of a favorite uncle to whom she had grown close. She was haunted by recurring dreams and nightmares that she could not remember when she awoke. She became more depressed and suicidal and was finally hospitalized. With more intensive therapy, she began recalling traumatic childhood events, opening up a Pandora's box of flooding memories. She recalled severe physical beatings by her mother and then began to remember her mother's sexual abuses, episodes in which her mother had inflicted vaginal douches and enemas and fondled her in order to clean her vagina. These rituals began when Elizabeth was about 8, shortly after her sister's death, and persisted until puberty. Her memories included looking into her mother's face and noting a benign, peaceful expression. These were the only times Elizabeth could remember when it appeared her mother was not disapproving. Elizabeth recalled sitting alone in the closet for many hours and often sleeping on the floor for fear of being molested in her bed. Sometimes she would sleep with a ribbon or award she had won in school. She found these actions to be comforting and continued them as an adult, often preferring the floor to her bed and spending time alone in a quiet room or dark closet. In the hospital, Elizabeth spoke of the different sides to her personality. She described fantasies of being different people and even gave these personality fragments separate names. These personae were independent women, had unique talents, and were either admired by others or snobbishly avoided social contacts. Elizabeth felt that whenever she accomplished something or was successful, it was due to the talents of one of these separate personality segments. She had great difficulty integrating these components into a stable self-concept. Nonetheless, she did recognize these as personality fragments, and they never took over her functioning. She suffered no clear periods of amnesia or dissociation, nor were her symptoms considered aspects of dissociative identity disorder, multiple personality, although this syndrome is frequently associated with BPD. Elizabeth used these other women to express the desires and feelings that she herself was forced to repress. Believing she was worthless, she felt these other partial identities were separate, stronger entities. Gradually, in the hospital, she learned that they were always a part of her. Recognizing this gave her relief and hope. She began to believe that she was stronger and less crazy than she had imagined, marking a turning point in her life. But she could not claim victory yet. Like a field officer, she commanded the various sides of her personality to stand before her and concluded that they could not go into battle without a unifying resolve. Elizabeth, the core of her being, was still afraid of change, love, and success, still searched in vain for safety, still fled from relationships. Coming to accept herself was going to be more difficult than she had ever imagined. After several weeks, Elizabeth left the hospital and continued in outpatient care. As she improved, her relationship with her husband deteriorated. But instead of blaming herself, as she typically did, she attempted to resolve the differences and to stay with him. She distanced herself from unhealthy contacts with family members. She developed more positive self-esteem. She began taking college courses and did remarkably well, achieving academic awards. She slept with her first award under her pillow, as she did when she was a child. Later, she entered law school and received merit awards for being the top student in her class. She developed new relationships with men and women and found she was comfortable in these without having to be in control. She became more content with her own femaleness. Little by little, Elizabeth started to heal. She felt the curtains raising. She compared the feeling to looking for a valuable antique in a dark attic filled with junk. She knew that it was in there somewhere, but couldn't see it because of all the clutter. When she finally did spot it, she couldn't get to it because it was buried under a pile of useless garbage. But now and then she could see a clear path to the object, as if a flash of lightning had illuminated the room for a brief instant. The flashes were all too brief. Old doubts reared up like ugly faces in an amusement park funhouse. Many times she felt as if she were going up a down escalator, struggling up one step only to fall down two. She kept wanting to sell herself short and give credit to others for her accomplishments. But her first real challenge, becoming an attorney, was almost a reality. 5 years before, she wouldn't have been able to talk about school, much less have had the courage to enroll. The timbre of her depressions began to change. Her depression over failing was now evolving, she recognized, into a fear of success. Growing and changing. Change is real hard work, Elizabeth often noted. It requires conscious retreat from unhealthy situations and the will to build healthier foundations. It entails coping with drastic interruption of a long-established equilibrium. Like Darwinian evolution, individual change happens almost imperceptibly, with much trial and error. The individual instinctively resists mutation. He may live in a kind of swamp, but it is his swamp. He knows where the alligators are, what's in all the bogs and marshes. To leave his swamp means venturing into the unknown and perhaps falling into an even more dangerous swamp. For the borderline, whose world is so clearly demarcated by black and white parameters, the uncertainty of change is even more threatening. She may clutch at one extreme for fear of falling uncontrollably into the abyss of another. The borderline anorexic, for example, starves herself out of the terror that eating, even a tiny morsel, will lead to total loss of control and irrevocable obesity. The borderline's fear of change involves a basic distrust of his breaks. In healthier people, these psychic breaks allow a gradual descent from the pinnacle of a mood or behavior to a gentle stop in the gray zone of the incline. Afraid that his set of breaks won't hold, the borderline believes that he won't be able to stop, that he will slide out of control to the bottom of the hill. Change, however gradual, requires the alteration of automatic reflexes. The borderline is in a situation much like a child playing a game of make me blink or make me laugh, struggling valiantly to stifle a blink or a laugh while another child waves his hand or makes funny faces. Such reflexes, established over many years, can be adjusted only with conscious, motivated effort. Adults sometimes engage in similar contests of will. A man who encounters an angry, barking dog in a strange neighborhood resists the automatic reflex to run away from the danger. He recognizes that if he runs, the dog would likely catch up with him and introduce an even greater threat. Instead, he takes the opposite and usually more prudent action. He stands perfectly still, allows the dog to sniff him, and then walks slowly on. Psychological change requires resisting unproductive automatic reflexes and consciously and willfully choosing other alternatives, choices that are different, even opposite from the automatic reflex. Sometimes these new ways of behaving are frightening, but they typically are more efficient ways of coping. Elizabeth and her psychiatrist embarked on her journey of change in regular weekly individual psychotherapy. Initial contacts focused on keeping Elizabeth safe. Cognitive techniques and suggestions colored early contacts. For several weeks, Elizabeth resisted the doctor's recommendation of starting antidepressant medicine, but soon after she agreed to the medication, she noticed significant improvement in her mood. The beginnings of change, self-assessment. Change for the borderline involves more of a fine-tuning than a total reconstruction. In rational weight loss diet plans, which almost always resist the urge to lose large amounts of weight very quickly, the best results come slowly and gradually over time when the weight loss will more likely endure. Likewise, change for the borderline is best initiated gradually with only slight alterations at first and must begin with self-assessment. Before plotting a new course, one must first recognize his current position and understand in which direction modification must progress. Imagine personality as a series of intersecting lines, each representing a specific character trait. The extremes of each trait are located at the ends of the line, with the middle ground in the center. For example, on the conscientiousness at work line, one end might indicate obsessive over-concern or workaholism, and the other end, irresponsibility or apathy. The middle would be an attitude somewhere between these two extremes, such as calm professionalism. If there were a concern about appearance line, one end might exemplify narcissistic attention to surface looks, and the other end, total disinterest. Ideally, one's personality makeup would look like the spokes of a perfectly round wheel with all these lines intersecting near their midpoints in the wheel hub. Of course, no one is completely centered all the time. It is important to identify each line in which change is desired and locate one's position on that line in relation to the middle. Change, then, becomes a process of knowing where you are and how far you want to go toward the middle. Except at the extreme ends, no particular locus is intrinsically better or worse than another. It is a matter of knowing oneself, locating oneself on the line, and moving in the adaptive direction. For example, if we isolate the caring for others line, one end, self-sacrificing over-concern, represents the point where concern for others interferes with taking care of oneself. Such a person may need to dedicate himself totally to others in order to feel worthwhile. This position may be perceived as a kind of selfish unselfishness, because such a person's caring is based on subconscious self-interest. At the other end, don't give a damn, is a person who has little regard for others, who only looks out for number one. In the middle is a kind of balance, a combination of concern for others and the obligation to take care of one's own needs as well. A person whose compassion trait resides in this middle zone recognizes that only by taking care of his own important needs first can he hope to help others, a kind of unselfish selfishness. Change occurs when one acquires the awareness to objectively place oneself on the spectrum and then compensate by adjusting behavior in a direction toward the middle. An individual who realistically locates his present position to the left of the midpoint would try to say no to others more often and generally attempt to be more assertive. One who places himself to the right of the midpoint would compensate toward the middle by choosing a course of action that is more sensitive to the needs of others. This position reflects the admonitions of the ancient scholar Hillel, "If I am not for myself, who will be for me? But if I am only for myself, who am I? If not now, when?" Of course, no one resides in the middle all the time. One must constantly adjust his position on the line, balancing the teeter-totter when it tilts too far in one direction or the other. Practicing change. True change requires more than experimenting with isolated attempts to alter automatic reflexes. It involves replacing old behaviors with new ones that eventually become as natural and comfortable as the old ones. It is more than quietly stealing away from the hostile dog. It is learning how to make friends with that dog and take it for a walk. Early on, such changes are usually uncomfortable. To use an analogy, a tennis player may decide that his unreliable backhand is in need of refinement, so he embarks on a series of tennis lessons to improve his stroke. The new techniques that he learns to improve his game initially yield poor results. The new style is not as comfortable as his old stroke. He is tempted to revert to his previous technique. Only after continuous practice is he able to eradicate his prior bad habits and instill the more effective and eventually more comfortable muscle memory. Likewise, psychological change requires the adoption of new reflexes to replace old ones. Only after persistent practice can such a substitution effectively, comfortably, and therefore permanently occur. Learning how to limp. If a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, the borderline's journey through the healing process begins with a single limp. Change is a monumental struggle for the borderline, much more difficult than for others because of the unique features of the disorder. Splitting and the lack of object constancy combine to form a menacing barricade against trusting oneself and others and developing comfortable relationships. In order to initiate change, the borderline must break out of an impossible catch-22 position. To accept himself and others, he must learn to trust. But to trust others really means starting to trust himself, that is, his own perceptions of others. He must also learn to accept their consistency and dependability, quite a task for someone who, like a small child, believes others disappear when they leave the room. "When I can't see you," Elizabeth told her psychiatrist early in her treatment, "it's like you don't exist." Like someone with an injured leg, the borderline must learn to limp. If he remains bedridden, his leg muscles will atrophy and contract. If he tries to exercise too vigorously, he will re-injure the leg even more severely. Instead, he must learn to limp on it, putting just enough weight on the leg to build strength gradually, but not so much as to strain it and prevent healing, tolerating leg pain that is slight but not overwhelming. Likewise, healing in the borderline requires placing just enough pressure by challenging himself to move forward. As Elizabeth's therapy progressed, cognitive interventions gave way to a more psychodynamic approach, with more attention focused on connections between her past experiences and current functioning. During this transition, the therapist's interventions diminished, and Elizabeth became responsible for more of the therapy. Leaving the past behind. The borderline's view of the world, like that of most people, is shaped by his childhood experiences in which the family served as a microcosm of the universe. Unlike healthier individuals, however, the borderline cannot easily separate himself from other family members, nor can he separate his family from the rest of the world. Unable to see his world through adult eyes, the borderline continues to experience life as a child, with a child's intense emotions and perspective. When a young child is punished or reprimanded, he sees himself as unquestionably bad. He cannot conceive of the possibility that mother might be having a bad day. As the healthy child matures, he sees his expanding world as more complex and less dogmatic, but the borderline remains stuck, a child in an adult's body. There is always one moment in childhood when the door opens and lets in the future, wrote Graham Greene in The Power and the Glory. In most borderlines' childhoods, the responsibilities of adulthood arrive too early. The door opens ever more widely, but he cannot face the light. Or perhaps it is the unrelenting opening that makes facing it so difficult. Change for the borderline comes when he learns to see current experiences and review past memories through adult lenses. The new vision is akin to watching an old horror film on TV that you haven't seen in years. The movie, once so frightening on the big screen, seems tame, even silly on a small screen with the lights on. You can't fathom why you were so scared when you saw it the first time. When Elizabeth was well into her journey in psychotherapy, she began to look at her early childhood feelings in a different light. She began to accept them, to recognize the value of her own experience, If not for those early feelings and experiences, she realized, she would not have been able to bring the same fervor and motivation she was bringing to her new career in law. Feelings born in my childhood, she said, still continue to haunt me, but I'm even seeing that in a different light. The very ways I have hated, I now accept as part of me. Playing the dealt hand. The borderline's greatest obstacle to change is his tendency to evaluate in absolute extremes. The borderline must either be totally perfect or a complete failure. He grades himself either an A+, or more commonly, an F. Rather than learning from his F, he wears it like a scarlet letter and so makes the same mistakes again and again, oblivious to the patterns of his own behavior, patterns from which he could learn and grow. Unwilling to play the hand that is dealt him, the borderline keeps folding every time, losing his ante, waiting to be dealt four aces. If he cannot be assured of winning, he won't play out the hand. Improvement comes when he learns to accept the hand for what it is and recognize that, skillfully played, he can still win. The borderline, like many people, is sometimes paralyzed by indecisiveness. Various alternatives seem overwhelming, and the borderline feels incapable of making any decisions. But as she matures, choices appear less frightening and may even become a source of pride and growing independence. At that point, the borderline recognizes that she faces decisions that only she is capable of making. "I'm finding," Elizabeth noted, "that the roots of my indecisiveness are the beginning of success. I mean, the agony of choosing is that I suddenly see choices." Boundary setting, establishing an identity. One of the borderline's primary goals is to establish a separate sense of identity and to overcome the proclivity to merge with others. In biological terms, it is like advancing from a parasitic life form to a state of symbiosis and even independence. Either symbiosis or independence can be terrifying, and most borderlines find that relying on themselves is like walking for the first time. In biology, the parasite's existence is entirely dependent on the host organism. If the parasitic tick sucks too much blood from the host dog, the dog dies and the tick soon follows. Human relationships function best when they are less parasitic and more symbiotic. In symbiosis, two organisms thrive better together, but may subsist independently. For example, moss growing on a tree may help the tree by shading it from direct sunlight, and help itself by having access to the tree's large supply of underground water. But if either the moss or the tree dies, the other may continue to survive, though less well. The borderline sometimes functions as a parasite whose demanding dependence may eventually destroy the person to whom he so strongly clings. When this person leaves, the borderline may be destroyed. If he can learn to establish more collaborative relationships with others, all may learn to live more contentedly. Elizabeth's increasing comfort with others started with her relationship with her psychiatrist. After months of testing his loyalty by berating and criticizing him and threatening to terminate therapy, Elizabeth began to trust his commitment to her. She began to accept his flaws and mistakes, rather than see them as proof of the inevitability of his failing her. After a while, Elizabeth began to extend the same developing trust to others in her life, and she began to accept herself, imperfections and all, just as she was accepting others the same way. As Elizabeth continued to improve, she became more confident that she would not lose her inner core. Where once she would squirm in a group of people, feeling self-conscious and out of place, she could now feel comfortable with others, letting them take responsibility for themselves and she for herself. Where once she felt compelled to adopt a role in order to fit into the group, she could now hold on to her more constant, immutable sense of self. Now she could stay the same color more easily. Establishing a constant identity means developing the ability to stand alone without relying on someone else to lean upon. It means trusting one's own judgment and instincts, and then acting rather than waiting for the feedback of others and then reacting. Building relationships. As the borderline forges a distinct core sense of identity, he also differentiates himself from others. Change requires the appreciation of others as independent persons and the empathy to understand their struggles. Their flaws and imperfections must not only be acknowledged, but also understood as separate from the borderline himself, part of the process of mentalization. When this task fails, relationships falter. Princess Diana mourned the loss of her fantasy of a fairy tale marriage to Prince Charles. "I had so many dreams as a young girl. I wanted and hoped that my husband would look after me. He would be a father figure and he'd support me, encourage me. But I didn't get any of that. I couldn't believe it. I got none of that. It was role reversal." The borderline must learn to integrate the positive and negative aspects of other individuals. When the borderline wants to get close to another person, he must learn to be independent enough to be dependent in comfortable, not desperate ways. He learns to function symbiotically, not parasitically. The healing borderline develops a constancy about himself and about others. Trust of others and of his own perceptions develops. The world becomes more balanced, more in between. Just as in climbing a mountain, the fullest experience comes when the climber can appreciate all the vistas, to look up and keep his goal firmly in view, to look down and recognize his progress as he proceeds, and finally, to rest, look around, and admire the view from right where he is at the moment. Part of the experience is recognizing that no one ever reaches the pinnacle. Life is a continuous climb up the mountain. A good deal of mental health is being able to appreciate the journey, to be able to grasp the serenity prayer invoked at most 12-step meetings. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Recognizing the effect of change on others. When an individual first enters therapy, he often does not understand that it is he, not others, who must make changes. However, when he does make changes, important people in his life must also adjust. Stable relationships are dynamic, fluctuating systems that have attained a state of equilibrium. When one person in that system makes significant changes in his ways of relating, others must adjust in order to recapture homeostasis, a state of balance. If these readjustments do not occur, the system may collapse and the relationships may shatter. For example, Alicia consults a psychotherapist for severe depression and anxiety. In therapy, she rails against her alcoholic husband, Adam, whom she blames for her feelings of worthlessness. Eventually, she recognizes her own role in the crumbling marriage, her own need to have others become dependent upon her, her reciprocal need to shame them, and her fears of reaching for independence. She begins to blame Adam less. She develops new independent interests and relationships. She stops her crying episodes. She stops initiating fights over his drinking. The equilibrium of the marriage is altered. Adam may now find that the situation is much more uncomfortable than it was before. He may escalate his drinking in an unconscious attempt to reestablish the old equilibrium and compel Alicia to return to her martyred caretaking role. He may accuse her of seeing other men and try to disrupt their relationship, now intolerable to him. Or he too can begin to see the necessity for change and his own responsibility in maintaining this pathological equilibrium. He may take the opportunity to see his own actions more clearly and reevaluate his own life, just as he has seen his wife do. Participation in therapy may be a valuable experience for everyone affected. The more interesting and knowledgeable Elizabeth became, the more ignorant her husband seemed to her. The more open-minded she became, the more gray she was able to perceive in a situation. The more black and white he became in order to reestablish equilibrium. She felt that she was leaving someone behind. That person was her, or more closely, a part of her she no longer needed or wanted. She was, in her words, growing up. As Elizabeth's treatment wound down, she met less regularly with her doctor, yet still had to contend with other important people in her life. She fought with her brother, who refused to own up to his drug problem. He accused her of being uppity, of using her new psychological crap as ammunition. They argued bitterly over the lack of communication within the family. He told her that even after all the shrinks, she was still screwed up. She fought with her mother, who remained demanding, complaining, and incapable of showing her any love. She contended with her husband, who professed his love, but continued to drink heavily and criticize her desire to pursue her education. He refused to help her with their son, and after a while she suspected his frequent absences were related to an affair with another woman. Finally, Elizabeth began to recognize that she did not have the power to change others. She utilized set techniques to try to better understand these family members and maintain protective boundaries for herself, which could shield her from being pulled into further conflicts. She began to accept them for who they were, love them as best she could, and go on with her own life. She recognized the need for new friends and new activities in her life. Elizabeth called this going home. Appendix: Evolution of the Borderline Syndrome. The concept of the borderline personality has evolved primarily through the theoretical formulations of psychoanalytic writers. Current DSM-4 TR criteria, observable, objective, and statistically reliable principles for defining this disorder, are derived from the more abstract, speculative writings of psychoanalytic theorists over the past 100 years. Freud. During Sigmund Freud's era at the turn of the century, psychiatry was a branch of medicine closely aligned with neurology. Psychiatric syndromes were defined by directly observable behaviors, as opposed to unobservable, mental, or unconscious mechanisms, and most forms of mental illness were attributed to neurophysiological aberrations. Though Freud himself was an experienced neurophysiologist, he explored the mind through different portals. He developed the concept of the unconscious and initiated a legacy of psychological, rather than physiological, exploration of human behavior. Yet he remained convinced that physiological mechanisms would eventually be uncovered to coincide with his psychological theories. Over a century after Freud's landmark work, we have come almost full circle. Today, diagnostic classifications are once again defined by observable phenomena, and new frontiers of research into BPD and other types of mental illness are again exploring neurophysiological factors, while acknowledging the impact of psychological and environmental factors. Freud's explication of the unconscious mind is the underpinning of psychoanalysis. He believed that psychopathology resulted from the conflict between primitive unconscious impulses and the conscious mind's need to prevent these abhorrent, unacceptable thoughts from entering awareness. He first used hypnosis, and later free association, and other classical psychoanalytical techniques to explore his theories. Ironically, Freud intended classical psychoanalysis to be primarily an investigative tool rather than a form of treatment. His colorful case histories, The Rat Man, The Wolf Man, Little Hans, Anna O, etc., were published to support his evolving theories as much as to promote psychoanalysis as a treatment method. Many current psychiatrists believe that these patients, whom Freud felt exhibited hysteria and other types of neuroses, would today clearly be identified as borderline. Post-Freud psychoanalytic writers. Psychoanalysts who followed Freud were the main contributors to the modern concept of the borderline syndrome. In 1925, Wilhelm Reich's Impulsive Character described attempts to apply psychoanalysis to certain unusual characterological disorders that he encountered in his clinic. He found that the impulsive character was often immersed in two sharply contradictory feeling states at the same time, but was able to maintain the states without apparent discomfort via the splitting mechanism, a concept that has become central to all subsequent theories on the borderline syndrome, particularly Kernberg's. In the late 1920s and early 1930s, The followers of the British psychoanalyst Melanie Klein investigated the cases of many patients who seemed just beyond the reach of psychoanalysis. The Kleinians focused on psychological dynamics as opposed to biological constitutional factors. The term borderline was first coined by Adolf Stern in 1938 to describe a group of patients who did not seem to fit into the primary diagnostic classifications of neuroses and psychoses. These individuals were obviously more ill than neurotic patients, in fact, too ill for classical psychoanalysis, yet they did not, like psychotic patients, continually misinterpret the real world. Though like neurotics, they displayed a wide range of anxiety symptoms, neurotic patients usually had a more solid, consistent sense of identity and used more mature coping mechanisms. Throughout the 1940s and 1950s, other psychoanalysts began to recognize a population of patients who did not fit existing pathological descriptions. Some patients appeared to be neurotic or mildly symptomatic, but when they engaged in traditional psychotherapy, especially psychoanalysis, they unraveled. Similarly, hospitalization would also exacerbate symptoms and increase the patient's infantile behavior and dependency on the therapist and hospital. Other patients would appear to be severely psychotic, often diagnosed schizophrenic, only to make a sudden and unexpected recovery within a very short time. Such dramatic improvement is inconsistent with the usual course of schizophrenia. Still other patients exhibited symptoms suggestive of depression, but their radical swings in mood did not fit the usual profile of depressive disorders. Psychological testing also confirmed the presence of a new unique classification. Certain patients performed normally on structured psychological tests, such as IQ tests, but on unstructured projective tests requiring narrative personalized responses, such as the Rorschach inkblot test, their responses were much more akin to those of psychotic patients, who displayed thinking and fantasizing on a more regressed, more childlike level. During this post-war period, psychoanalysts fastened onto different aspects of the syndrome, seeking to develop a succinct delineation. In many ways, the situation was like the old tale of the blind men who stood around an elephant and touched its various anatomical parts, trying to identify them. Each man described a different animal, of course, depending on which part he touched. Similarly, researchers were able to touch and identify different aspects of the borderline syndrome, but could not quite see the whole organism. Many researchers, Zilburg, Huck and Palatin, Bykowski, and others, and DSM-II, 1968, rallied around the schizophrenia-like aspects of the disorder using such terms as ambulatory schizophrenia, pre-schizophrenia, pseudo-neurotic schizophrenia, and latent schizophrenia to describe the illness. Others concentrated on these patients' lack of a consistent core sense of identity. In 1942, Helene Deutsch described a group of patients who overcame an intrinsic sense of emptiness by a chameleon-like altering of their internal and external emotional experiences to fit the people and situations they were involved with at the moment. She termed this tendency of adopting the qualities of others as a means of gaining or retaining their love the as-if personality. In 1953, Robert Knight revitalized the term borderline in his consideration of borderline states. He recognized that even though certain patients presented markedly different symptoms and were categorized with different diagnoses, they were expressing a common pathology. After Knight's work was published, the term borderline became more popular, and the possibility of using Stern's general borderline concept as a diagnosis became more acceptable. In 1968, Roy Grinker and his colleagues defined four subtypes of the borderline patient. 1. A severely afflicted group who bordered on the psychotic. 2. A core borderline cluster with turbulent interpersonal relationships, intense feeling states, and loneliness. 3. An as-if group, easily influenced by others and lacking in stable identity. And 4. a mildly impaired set with poor self-confidence and bordering on the neurotic end of the spectrum. Yet even with all this extensive pioneering research, the diagnosis of borderline personality among working clinicians was still drenched in ambiguity. It was considered a wastebasket diagnosis by many, a place to dump those patients who were not well understood, who resisted therapy, or who simply did not get better. The situation remained that way well into the 1970s. As borderline personality became more rigorously defined and distinguishable from other syndromes, attempts were made to change the ambiguous name. At one point, unstable personality was briefly considered during the development of DSM-3. However, borderline character pathology is relatively fixed and invariable, at least for a considerable period, despite its chaos. It is predictably stable in its instability. No other names have been prominently proposed as a replacement. In the 1960s and 1970s, two major schools of thought evolved to delineate a consistent set of criteria for defining the borderline syndrome. Like some other disciplines in the natural and social sciences, psychiatry was split ideologically into two primary camps, one more concept-oriented, the other more influenced by descriptive, observable behavior that could be more easily retested and studied under laboratory conditions. The empirical school, led by John G. Gunderson of Harvard and favored by many researchers, developed a structured, more behavioral definition, one based on observable criteria and thus more accessible to research and study. This definition is the most widely accepted and in 1980 was adopted by DSM-3 and perpetuated in DSM-4. The other more concept-oriented school, led by Otto Kernberg of Cornell and favored by many psychoanalysts, proposes a more psychostructural approach that describes the syndrome based on intrapsychic functioning and defense mechanisms rather than overt behaviors. Kernberg's Borderline Personality Organization, BPO. In 1967, Otto Kernberg introduced his concept of Borderline Personality Organization, BPO, a broader concept than the current DSM-4's Borderline Personality Disorder. Kernberg's conceptualization places BPO midway between neurotic and psychotic personality organization. A patient with BPO, as defined by Kernberg, is less impaired than a psychotic whose perceptions of reality are severely contorted, making normal functioning impossible. On the other hand, the borderline is more disabled than a person with neurotic personality organization who experiences intolerable anxiety as a result of emotional conflicts. The neurotic's perception of identity and system of defense mechanisms are usually more adaptive than those of the borderline. BPO encompasses other access to or characterological disorders such as paranoid, schizoid, antisocial, histrionic, and narcissistic personality disorders. In addition, it includes obsessive-compulsive and chronic anxiety disorders, hypochondriasis, phobias, sexual perversions, and dissociative reactions, such as dissociative identity disorder, also known as multiple personality disorder. In Kernberg's system, patients currently diagnosed with BPD would constitute only about 10-25% of patients classified BPO. A patient diagnosed with BPD is conceived as occupying a lower functioning, higher severity level within the overall BPO diagnosis. Though Kernberg's system was not officially adopted by the APA, his work has had and continues to have significant influence as a theoretical model for both clinicians and researchers. In general, Kernberg's schema emphasizes the inferred internal mechanisms discussed next. Variable sense of reality. Like neurotics, borderlines retain contact with reality most of the time. However, under stress, the borderline can regress to a brief psychotic state. Marjorie, a 29-year-old married woman, sought therapy for increasing depression and marital disharmony. An intelligent, attractive woman, Marjorie related calmly throughout her initial 8 sessions. She eagerly assented to a joint interview with her husband, but during the session, she turned uncharacteristically loud and belligerent. Dropping her facade of self-control, she began to berate her husband for alleged infidelities. She accused her therapist of taking her husband's side. "You men always stick together," and accused both of engaging in a conspiracy against her. The sudden transformation from a relaxed, mildly depressed woman to a raging, paranoid one is quite characteristic of the kind of rapidly shifting borders of reality observed in the borderline. Nonspecific weaknesses in functioning. Borderlines have great difficulty tolerating frustration and coping with anxiety. In Kernberg's framework, impulsive behavior is an attempt to diffuse this tension. Borderlines also have defective sublimation tools, that is, they are unable to channel frustrations and discomforts in socially adaptive ways. Though borderlines may exhibit extreme empathy, warmth, and guilt, these exhibitions are often rote, more manipulative gestures for display purposes only, rather than true expressions of feeling. Indeed, the borderline may act as if he has totally forgotten a dramatic effusion that occurred only moments before, much like a child who suddenly emerges from a temper tantrum, all smiles and laughter. Primitive thinking. Borderlines are capable of performing well in a structured work or professional environment, but below the surface linger grave self-doubts, suspicions, and fears. The internal thought processes of borderlines may be surprisingly unsophisticated and primal, camouflaged by a stable facade of learned and rehearsed platitudes. Any circumstance that pierces the protective structure shielding the borderline may unleash a flood of chaotic passions concealed within. The example of Marjorie illustrates this point. Projective psychological tests also reveal the borderline's primitive thought processes. These tests, such as the Rorschach and thematic apperception test, TAT, elicit associations to ambiguous stimuli, such as inkblots or pictures, around which the patient creates a story. Borderline responses typically resemble those of schizophrenics and other psychotic patients. Unlike the coherent, organized responses usually observed among neurotic patients, those from borderlines often describe bizarre, primitive images. The borderline might see vicious animals cannibalizing one another, where the neurotic sees a butterfly. Primitive defense mechanisms. The coping mechanism of splitting preserves the borderline's perception of a world of extremes, a view in which people and objects are either good or bad, friendly or hostile, loved or hated, in order to escape the anxiety of ambiguity and uncertainty. In Kernberg's conceptualization, splitting often leads to magical thinking. Superstitions, phobias, obsessions, and compulsions are used as talismans to ward off unconscious fears. Splitting also results in derivative defense mechanisms. Primitive idealization, insistently placing a person or object in the all-good category so as to avoid the anxiety accompanying the recognition of faults in that person. Devaluation, an unrelenting negative view of a person or object, the opposite of idealization. Using this mechanism, the borderline avoids the guilt of his rage. The all-bad person fully deserves it. Omnipotence, a feeling of unlimited power in which one feels incapable of failure or sometimes even of death. Omnipotence is also a common feature in the narcissistic personality. Projection, disavowing features unacceptable to the self and attributing them to others. Protective identification, a more complex form of projection in which the projector continues an ongoing manipulative involvement with another person who is the object of the projection. The other person wears these unacceptable characteristics for the projector, who works to ensure their continued expression. For example, Mark, a young married man who is diagnosed as borderline, finds his own sadistic and angry impulses unacceptable and projects them onto his wife Sally. Sally is then perceived by Mark, in his black-and-white fashion, to be a totally angry woman. All of her actions are interpreted as sadistic. he unconsciously pushes her buttons to extract angry responses, thus confirming his projections. In this way, Mark fears yet simultaneously controls his perception of Sally. Pathological concept of self. Identity diffusion describes Kernberg's conception of the borderline's lack of a stable core sense of identity. The borderline's identity is the consistency of jello. It can be molded into any configuration that contains it, but slips through the hands when you try to pick it up. This lack of substance leads directly to the identity disturbances outlined in Criterion 3 of DSM-4's description of BPD. Pathological concept of others. As identity diffusion describes the borderline's lack of a stable concept of self, object inconstancy describes the lack of a stable concept of others. Just as his own self-esteem depends on current circumstances, the borderline bases his attitude toward another person on the most recent encounter, rather than on a more stable and enduring perception grounded in a consistent, connected series of experiences. Often, the borderline is unable to hold on to the memory of a person or object when he, she, or it is not present. Like a child who becomes attached to a transitional object that represents a soothing mother figure, such as Linus's attachment to his blanket in the Peanuts cartoons, the borderline uses objects, such as pictures and clothing, to simulate the presence of another person. For example, when a borderline is separated from home for even a brief period, he typically takes many personal objects as soothing reminders of familiar surroundings. Teddy bears and other stuffed animals accompany him to bed, and snapshots of family are carefully placed around the room. If he is left home while his wife is away, he often stares longingly at her picture and her closet, and smells her pillow, seeking the comfort of familiarity. For many borderlines, out of sight, out of mind, is an excruciatingly real truism. Panic sets in when the borderline is separated from a loved one because the separation feels permanent. Because memory cannot be adequately utilized to retain an image, the borderline forgets what the object of his concern looks like, sounds like, feels like. To escape the panicky sensation of abandonment and loneliness, the borderline tries to cling desperately, calling, writing, using any means to maintain contact.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, Understanding the Borderline Personality, completely revised and updated, by Gerald J. Kreisman, M.D., and Hal Strauss. Read by Mel Foster. This program was directed by Jeff Bukema. Text copyright 2010 by Gerald J. Kreisman, M.D., and Hal Strauss. Production copyright 2012, Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.